Minsky was avoiding every opportunity to rule on the issue. Knowing the lab tests had been consistent with drowning, Bernie Flynn was even more disenchanted with the case. "The investigation was unlike anything we'd ever done before," he said. "There was something unusual about the whole thing. It seemed like everybody wanted to get the damn thing over with as fast as they could to appease the press. Nobody in the district attorney's office said, 'Come up with information.' We were never told what crime we were investigating. Usually we know what somebody's being charged with, so we go out and dig up the evidence to support the charge." The scene was one of panic for many weeks. Panic in the DA's office, panic in the registry and in the press. I'm standing there observing it every day, and ideas are going through my head. Flynn admired the Kennedy family. "When Jack and Bobby got killed, the whole country mourned. Because of my feelings, naturally, after two assassinations, I started feeling sorry for Ted Kennedy during the course of this thing. Because I'm thinking, what the hell is going on? Denise is supposedly prosecuting him. The press is like a goddamn lynch mob. My theory was Kennedy wasn't in the car. But even if he was, it was an accident. He certainly didn't qualify for this hangman vigilante gang going after him." Flynn related his theory about the accident to journalist Jack Olson, also embarked upon writing a book about the case, during lunch at a restaurant near the courthouse in Edgartown. "Ted Kennedy didn't want to admit being drunk with a broad in a car late at night. When he saw Huck look, he got scared. He thought a cop was coming after him." Flynn couldn't prove Ted Kennedy had gotten out of the car before the accident, and he didn't expect the senator to recant his previous statements. True or not, Kennedy was stuck with the other story. Flynn didn't think Olson was very impressed by his theory. Andy Tooney reserved judgment about the senator's guilt in the accident. Tooney was working on a stolen art case, in which the thief had offered to sell the paintings back to the insurance company. Because the robbery had occurred on Cape Cod, Tooney was consulting George Killen at Barnstable Courthouse. After the meeting, Flynn invited Tooney to have lunch at the Coonamesset Inn in Falmouth. Flynn had never met Tooney before, but I knew of him by reputation. Tooney was a celebrity cop, head of the Boston Strangler Bureau, which had cracked the famous murder case. After 19 years with the state police, Tooney resigned to become F. Lee Bailey's private investigator. During lunch, Tooney said, "I hear you're working on the Chappaquiddick case. How are things going?" Flynn was glad Tooney brought the subject up. "I was telling him about my feelings about Ted Kennedy, the poor bastard. He's getting a raw deal," Flynn recalled. "That goddamn TV speech made him look like a jerk. I know he's lying, whatever the reason. He got bad advice. I thought he's really going to get it put to him when he gets to that inquest and keeps lying. He's going to be gone." Flynn told Tooney, "Jesus, I'd like to help the guy out. I think he's in a bind." The only way Flynn could think of to help Ted Kennedy was to let him know what certain people were going to testify to at the inquest. Bernie was very anxious to be put in contact with Ted Kennedy's office in Boston, Tooney said later. "He figured I'd know how to make the call, because I'd worked both sides of the street as a state cop and a private investigator." Tooney was no Kennedy lover, he said. "I wouldn't have stepped out of the way to help Ted Kennedy." Before Tooney did anything, he sought the advice of F. Lee Bailey. Andy said he knew where there was some information which could be helpful to Ted Kennedy with respect to the inquest, Bailey said. "He was asking me, should I volunteer to pass it along or just stay out of it?" Bailey spent no time thinking about it at all. It wasn't even a conference. Andy mentioned it, and I said, "Sure, if it's helpful to Teddy Kennedy, see that he gets it." Bailey didn't know the informer was a police officer engaged in investigating the case. He had no idea somebody in Edmund Denise's office was involved. "But I rather think, because I knew Ed's attitude, that wouldn't have bothered me," Bailey said, "because I think Ed Denise would have given Teddy Kennedy or his lawyers anything he had to prepare him for the inquest." Tooney called Kennedy's Boston office. He had urgent and important information about Chappaquiddick. "He didn't want to talk to any aide, secretary, or anybody else," he said. "I only want to talk to Ted Kennedy." Tooney was sure his call would be returned when he gave his name as F. Lee Bailey's private investigator. He said, "I'd been chief of the Boston Strangler Bureau. My name had been in the papers all the time." The next day, Tooney received a call from Stephen Smith. He recognized him as Ted Kennedy's brother-in-law. Tooney said he wanted to talk to the senator. Smith said, "Well, you can't do that. He's not here." Tooney wasn't prepared to give out the information to just anybody, he said later. "It had to be somebody close, or I wouldn't have said a word." Tooney told Smith, "Well, it's some very important information a state police officer wants to relay to Ted." Tooney didn't know what the information was. "Bernie didn't tell me anything, except he was willing to show Ted Kennedy the district attorney's file on the case before he went to court. That's what he intended doing, because he admired Ted and the Kennedy family so much." Smith assured Tooney the information would go to Ted Kennedy and nobody else. Smith would relay it direct, he said. "I'll see that the senator gets the message." Chapter 44 Flynn was surprised to receive a call from Tooney at Barnstable Courthouse. "At the time I talked with Tooney, I didn't think he was serious about putting me in contact with somebody in Ted's office. I wasn't expecting anything to come out of the conversation. We were having a couple of drinks. I figured it was just barroom talk." If Flynn wanted to help Ted Kennedy, Tooney had two numbers for Stephen Smith in New York. Home, 212-RE7-9946. Office, 212-TN7-4900. Flynn copied the numbers in a black address book he was keeping for people he wanted to have a file on when he transferred from New Bedford to Cape Cod. Stephen Smith was expecting Flynn to call, Tooney said. "It won't be cold." "Tooney saying that helped me out," Flynn said, "because I wouldn't have to explain who I was." Flynn gave it a lot of thought before he called Stephen Smith, aware of the risk involved in what he was contemplating doing. "This went beyond all my character to do this. The first time I've been on a case and gone over to the opposition and tell them what's going on. It's something I'm not comfortable with." Flynn discussed the idea of passing evidence of the investigation with his girlfriend, Jacqueline Buzzy. She thought it was a good idea to help Ted Kennedy. There was the matter of Flynn's vulnerability to transfer from Cape Cod to some less desirable assignment with the state police. It couldn't do any harm to have Ted Kennedy obliged to him about an investigation that wasn't going anywhere anyway. Denise wasn't serious about hanging a rap on Ted Kennedy. He was only going through the motions to get the press off his back. Flynn called Stephen Smith's office in New York. When he gave his name to the secretary, "I was put right through. There was no hesitation. There wasn't anything like, 'Who is this?' If I had to explain who I was, I probably wouldn't have gone through with it," Flynn said. "But everything was set up. Stephen Smith wasn't surprised to hear from me. He knew who I was." Flynn had been told to call this number, he said. He wanted to talk about Chappaquiddick. Smith asked him to call him at home. When Flynn did that evening, "I told him my position, but I think he knew it. He wasn't saying too much on the phone. Maybe he was afraid it was a police trap or something. My gut feeling about his attitude was, he's wondering, why is this guy offering to do this?" The initial phone call indicated he was going to get in touch with Teddy Kennedy. Smith had to check this out with the senator, he said. He wanted Flynn to call him back in a couple of days, within the week. Years of backroom maneuvering as financial director of Kennedy campaigns had prepared Stephen Smith to be the perfect confidential agent for Ted Kennedy, following a tradition that the most delicate political assignments were always kept in the family. The team of lawyers working on the inquest had been compartmentalized by their specialty. Edward Hanafy had overall legal command of the case and had handled the constitutional issues of the appeal. Clark, as a motor vehicle specialist, was given the dirty work of dealing with the registry in matters bearing directly on the accident. Retained to defend Ted Kennedy in Edgartown District Court, Dick McCarran was now no more than resident agent for Kennedy's interests on Martha's Vineyard. Others played a role: Ted Sorensen, Richard Goodwin, and Milton Gwertzman. Burke Marshall and William Vandenhuvel later claimed a lawyer-client relationship with Ted Kennedy on the case. To this squadron of lawyers was added another, one who played out his crucial role in history's shadows. His name was Herbert J. Miller, Jr. A top-flight defense lawyer, the pragmatic, pun-loving Miller, had built a solid reputation in Washington after Bobby Kennedy picked him to head the criminal division of the Justice Department from 1961 to 1965. In that role, he captained Bobby Kennedy's final offensive in his long campaign to put Teamster chieftain Jimmy Hoffa behind bars. With Kennedy's future hanging in the balance, Stephen Smith tapped Miller for a vital but volatile assignment: to receive evidence from Flynn of the ongoing state police investigation into the accident at Chappaquiddick. Kennedy's brain trust realized that, as tempting an advantage as it was to have access to those files, it was also flirting with charges of judicial espionage or obstruction of justice. Smith concluded that it would take a man of Miller's shrewd mind and legal acumen to handle such an explosive assignment. That Miller had joined the Kennedy juggernaut was to remain the best-kept secret of the cover-up. His connection with the case never has, until now, been revealed. Stephen Smith was ready to do business when Flynn called him back. "I'll give you this name and make arrangements for you to meet this person in Washington," Smith said. Flynn had a ready-made cover story. He was working on a Picayune case, a breaking and entering involving larcenies of motel television sets, Flynn said. He needed to consult with Joseph Lanzetta, a former civilian employee of the Massachusetts State Police, then working in a Washington crime lab, to see what Lanzetta could testify to if the case ever came to trial. I had to go to Washington anyway, and I had carte blanche as to when. Smith instructed Flynn to call Miller, "When you hit Washington." Flynn recalled, "He said his name was Herbert or Henry, but everybody called him Jack." As soon as he arrived in Washington, 2 days later, Flynn dialed the number Smith had given him for Miller, Cassidy, LaRocca, and Lewin. He was put through at once to Jack Miller. Flynn told him he was calling from the airport. Miller said, "Stay there. I'll meet you in 20 minutes." He directed Flynn to a lobby lounge area at the airport. Miller would be hatless, wearing a black cashmere topcoat and carrying a briefcase, he said. Flynn described himself: "Blonde hair, no hat, and I'm wearing a trench coat, light collar." Flynn was disappointed Miller was coming to him, "Because I'd made the trip all the way down there. I figured he's going to say, grab a cab and come over to the office. We can have lunch or something." Miller plainly preferred the anonymity of an airport. Flynn spotted Miller from his description as soon as he appeared. "A good-looking guy, late 40s, a little shorter than me, nice stature, and very self-confident." Miller introduced himself. He said Stephen Smith had contacted him. Miller took a seat on a bench in the center of the lobby. Flynn was immediately put on guard when Miller placed a briefcase on the floor beside him. I said to myself, "He's going to start taping." "What the hell, I'm no dummy," Flynn said. There was no reason for him to be carrying a briefcase. He never opened it. He didn't say, "I want to take down notes on a yellow pad or something," which I was expecting. That's when I knew he was nervous. I can't blame him. He doesn't know who I am or what I'm going to do. It kind of made me uneasy knowing it was being taped, but I had committed myself. Plus the fact, Miller is going to be using the tape to tell Stephen Smith and Ted Kennedy what I said. Flynn was at pains to explain, "I'm doing this because Ted Kennedy was not in the car. That was my opinion. I could be entirely wrong. My main purpose is, I don't want Ted Kennedy to get caught in a big lie that could really make him go down the drain. The reason I'm there is not to have Ted Kennedy go into the inquest and start lying again. Because in my opinion, he'd already lied in the police report and the TV speech, and I liked the guy. I knew he had presidential aspirations." Flynn's meeting with Miller was primarily to give him evidence. Flynn had copies of all investigative reports, but brought none of these to the meeting. "I kind of selected in my own mind what I thought was important," Flynn said. "Everything was to be delivered verbally." Huck Look was going to be the major problem at the inquest. His testimony checked out. "The man is honest," Flynn said. "He has no reason to lie. So there's a time gap there, like an hour and a half off what Kennedy said it was. Flynn delivered the whole context of Look's testimony, what he's going to say at the inquest. The reason Look knows he saw the car at 12:45 a.m., he was a special police officer at a party at the Edgartown Yacht Club. He knows what time he quit work, naturally. He's on the way home, and he sees a car backing out of the road to the cemetery. Then Flynn went into what he surmised. Teddy Kennedy was in the bag, no question in my mind about that. And the most important thing to him at this time is not getting locked up for driving under. Flynn revealed the new witnesses we had, Ross Richards and Stan Moore. They were going to testify to what happened the next morning on the porch of the Shiretown Inn. They had a description of Ted Kennedy talking, that he wasn't upset, contradicting what he told police about being in a state of shock after the accident. Moore had refused to talk to police about drinking on Richards' boat after the regatta race, which suggested Kennedy had half a bag on before the party at Chappaquiddick, information of vital importance, given a possible manslaughter charge emanating from the inquest. In addition, the investigation had uncovered several witnesses who could testify to the noise level of the party, and the fact that it had not been a quiet barbecue, as reported in the press. The Registry of Motor Vehicles was walking on tiptoes around the case, Flynn said, because Ted Kennedy's license had expired, information that was common knowledge in the district attorney's office. Miller didn't ask for anything specific, Flynn observed. He's just following the trend of the information I'm giving out. He's sitting there listening, not writing anything down. He isn't saying too much. He didn't want his voice talking on the tape. After Flynn's recital, Miller said, "Is that it? Do you have anything else?" Flynn didn't. If anything important came up, he'd get in touch with Stephen Smith. Miller thanked him, shook hands, then left the lobby. The meeting took between 20 minutes to a half an hour. Flynn took a cab and checked into a hotel in downtown Washington. He called Joseph Lanzetta at 4:30 p.m. Lanzetta met him after he got off work for a drink at the hotel's lounge. More hospitable than Miller, Lanzetta asked Flynn to his house in Virginia to meet his wife and have dinner. After a few drinks at a local bar, Lanzetta drove Flynn back to Washington. He observed the passing landscape of the Capitol. "All lit up at night," Flynn said, "and I really enjoyed that." Flynn flew back to Cape Cod the next morning. He made out an expense voucher charging the Washington trip to the district attorney's office. "Stephen Smith didn't send me an airplane ticket or anything," Flynn said. "He didn't say, 'I'll pay your way down.'" Flynn didn't report his meeting with Miller to Andy Tooney. "I never called down to the Cape to find out whatever the hell it was Bernie did, whether he ever got together with Ted Kennedy and went over the case with him," Tooney said. He never mentioned the subject of Chappaquiddick again to F. Lee Bailey. Bailey had the impression Tooney gave something to somebody, he said. "I presumed it had something to do with areas of the investigation, but I don't know what it was, where he got it from, or who he gave it to. I assumed Judge Clark." Bailey said nothing about the incident to Denise. By the time this happened, Ed and I didn't have an occasion to chat about Chappaquiddick. Bailey wouldn't have hesitated to mention that somebody from his office had passed information to Ted Kennedy, he said. "I don't think Ed would have objected. He certainly didn't have anything against Ted Kennedy. If he'd wanted to prosecute him for something, he probably could have gotten a manslaughter indictment out of a grand jury. But I don't think he felt disposed that way at all." Nor was the appeal pending before the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court at issue. Any secrecy order would be to prevent publicity in the event of a criminal prosecution, in Bailey's opinion. The Supreme Court wouldn't rule that information be kept secret from the target of the investigation, Ted Kennedy. Chapter 45. With Huck Look identified as the most damaging witness at the inquest, Edward Hanafy retained private investigator J.E. Gautreaux of Confidential Services Limited of Arlington, Massachusetts, to conduct an investigation of Look and other witnesses scheduled to testify. Look was a little bit upset when he found out. Investigators for Kennedy were knocking on doors all over Edgartown, asking old ladies if I get drunk or run around with women. Well, everybody knows that I don't. But even if I did, that wouldn't change what I saw. Dutroux's investigation was discontinued at Richard McCarran's request. Because it didn't work. The press got onto him too fast, and so did people in Edgartown. Luke's reputation was exemplary, McCarran said. My attitude was, why are we investigating Huck if he's telling the truth? The fact an investigation had been undertaken was McCarran's only question about Luke's story, he said. I didn't have any doubt Huck saw what he said he saw. McCarran sought to resolve the mystery of that confrontation himself. Securing a registry list of property owners assessed to Chappaquiddick as of January 1, 1969, he questioned only a few residents seeking to locate a black sedan with an L7 Massachusetts registration before giving up. It was the same problem the investigator had, McCarran said. People just got on too fast to what I was doing. McCarran was deeply involved in an investigation of another kind, having received permission from George Killen for tests to be performed on the accident car, impounded at State Police Barracks at Oak Bluffs. McCarran had asked the tests not to be divulged, but Daniel I. Murphy, captain of the State Police Bureau, didn't want his agency accused of favoritism by allowing experiments to be conducted in secret. Murphy released the information that an investigation into the physical factors of the accident was being undertaken by a 10-man team from the Arthur D. Little Company, a research consultant firm of Cambridge. Senator Kennedy was concerned about statements made by John Farrar that Mary Jo Kopechne could have breathed in a pocket of air long enough to have been rescued if help had been sought out immediately after the accident. Above all, Kennedy has told friends, he wants to prove that Mary Jo could not have survived in the submerged car, even if he had immediately summoned help, instead of waiting 9 hours to report the accident. A delay which had provoked speculation that Senator Kennedy had tried to avoid being implicated in any report of Miss Kopechne's death. The idea that Kennedy had bolted from the scene and abandoned Mary Jo Kopechne to die a slow, terrifying death by asphyxiation was so damaging to his case as to have prompted experiments to determine how long she could have survived after the accident. A mannequin of her approximate size and weight was used in a test during which the accident car was flipped over and jarred with the same impact with which it had struck the water in Poca Pond. The mannequin was thrown into the rear seat of the car with a force sufficient to stun and possibly disorient a human being. Hoisted by a wrecker into a position to simulate that in which it was discovered, the car was filled with water from a state police garden hose to determine how quickly air had been displaced in the back seat. 2 days of tests concluded that Mary Jo Kopechne had remained conscious for 1 to 4 minutes. She could have been revived up to 10 minutes after losing consciousness. John Farrar regarded the tests as worse than useless, he said. How they can recreate the conditions, I don't know. Filling a car with water is not the same as having it submerged. It seems certain they are doing all this to try to discredit my evidence. But the big difference is, I went down to where a girl was trapped in a submerged car. The consulting firm didn't. In Farrar's opinion, there was no way to duplicate the circumstances of the accident, short of sinking the automobile all over again. Farrar's pronouncements about an air bubble having sustained Mary Jo Kopechne's life, and that she might have been saved if he'd been called at the time of the accident, had brought him some highly critical mail, he said. But I stand on my belief. McCarran was not concerned about Farrar's testimony, he said. John was a little screwy on the subject of the accident. A summer kid who'd moved to Edgartown in 1965. Farrar had held press conferences at the Turf and Tackle to explain his theories about the accident. No matter how expert his testimony was, Farrar had, by pontificating at such length about the accident, literally talked himself out of any credibility as a witness. But Arena, too, was skeptical about the value of tests conducted to replicate the accident. The accident car's wiring having been destroyed by vandals, a battery was placed directly on headlights to indicate the dimmer switch had been on high beam at the time of the accident. Using a 1969 Chevrolet with the same headlight configuration as the accident car, a test of visual factors was conducted to reproduce what the human eye would see approaching Dyke Bridge at night. Motion pictures revealed the bridge was visible less than 3 seconds if approached at 20 miles per hour. Still, photographs taken under the same conditions showed at a distance in excess of 100 feet. Headlights struck the ground in front and to the left of the bridge, then were deflected upward. Almost as though one's headlights have been turned out. An abrupt change in light intensity that could well distract a driver. As the car reached the bridge, headlights came down to illuminate the rub rail, and the realization that the road over the bridge angled to the left. Arena clocked the test car at 20 miles per hour for an experiment, during which brakes were applied the instant front wheels touched the bridge. Although the automobile stopped in 31 feet and did not plunge over the side, the test indicated that even allowing reasonable reaction time, braking only will not prevent a car traveling at a speed of 20 miles an hour from going over the rail. A result that appeared to confirm Registry Inspector George Kennedy's report of his examination of skid marks on the bridge, and other conditions. Inspector Kennedy had calculated the car had been operated at approximately 22 miles per hour at the time of the accident, an assessment Arena discounted entirely. "Maybe an engineer could do it," he said, "but I seriously doubted Red Kennedy would be able to tell much from the smudge marks I saw on the bridge." As a state trooper, Arena knew skid marks were evaluated on the basis of tire depth and length of skid. Dyke Road was dirt, sand, and gravel. If Senator Kennedy had attempted to brake before the accident, no skid marks would show up on that surface. Markings on wood were difficult to measure and even harder to evaluate. In Arena's opinion, Senator Kennedy had not attempted to brake at all, but had driven straight over the side of Dyke Bridge. Without braking, there could be no skid marks. And without skid marks, no way for Red Kennedy or anybody else to estimate rate of speed. As part of the tests commissioned on behalf of Senator Kennedy, a plan and elevation of Dyke Road's approach to the bridge was prepared from direct survey and aerial photographs. A consulting engineer found existing conditions at Dyke Bridge well below the minimum standards set by commonly used engineering criteria. The absence of warning signs, guardrails, lights, or reflectorized markers made the accident site particularly hazardous at night. Underwater photographs of the tide and current patterns in Poca Pond and the location of the accident car were taken by a scuba diver. Senator Kennedy's swim across the ferry channel was restaged by a person of his approximate weight and stature, preceded by some alcoholic intake to approximate conditions the night of the accident. Dukes County Sheriff John Palmyra refused McCarran's request to administer a breathalyzer test, since no criminal aspect was involved in the experiment. Palmyra said, "We use the breathalyzer when someone is arrested. It isn't a toy." Such elaborate and contrived experiments scandalized Edgartowners with rumors of thousands of dollars spent on the best evidence money can buy. In contrast to the sums at the disposal of Kennedy's defense team, a special appropriation bill passed by the legislature allowed the county of Dukes County to borrow $15,000 to pay for the scheduled inquest. In pursuit of justice, Edgartown couldn't compete with the Kennedy fortune. With costs of the defense mounting up, McCarran requested compensation to cover day-to-day expenses. A check for $5,000 was issued from Park Plaza, Inc., the Kennedy Family Corporation. When McCarran complained he hadn't received the money, an investigation revealed the check had been stolen from a tampered mail chute in the Pan Am building in New York and cashed the same day at a bank nearby. But more than money, scientific and legal expertise was being thrown at the problem of Chappaquiddick. A tireless propaganda machine was seeking to disperse the cloud of scandal hanging over Senator Kennedy, described as hurt and shaken by rumors attaching to the episode. Kennedy was disturbed in particular by one widely accepted line of speculation that there was never any question of catching the ferry, and that, after the accident, he at least entertained the notion of concealing his role by reporting that Miss Kopechne had been alone in the car. To repair the damage done to his career as a political leader, willing to speak out on important issues. Kennedy used the occasion of a testimonial dinner in Boston for the retiring president of the American Cancer Society to deliver a harsh condemnation of the Vietnam War as a conflict that was eroding the health, the economy, and the moral and spiritual strength of the nation, as surely as any disease that attacked the body. Response from a distinguished audience was lukewarm at best, the speech described as a palpable dud and a lackluster performance that revealed Kennedy was still suffering under the shadow of unanswered questions about the death of Mary Jo Kopechne. That the speech had not aroused marked enthusiasm was less surprising than Ted Kennedy had been audacious enough, less than 2 months after Chappaquiddick, to speak so indignantly about such virtues as moral strength, Sylvia Wright observed in Life magazine. Wright ascribed Kennedy's regained spirit to his job as Senate whip, and acceptance of the fact that he must and will face further questioning about the accident. Forbidden by court order from making public statements about the case, Kennedy had come to realize there was much more he should have said immediately after the accident. The advice taken, the solutions worked out in those rainy days inside the Hyannisport compound, were not, he now feels, along with many friends and family advisors, the best advice and solutions. Thus, the forthcoming inquest was less frightening to him than it is essential. Kennedy was eager to satisfy the widespread demand for information about the accident, Wright reported. If necessary, he would probably be willing to be interviewed by newsmen on a TV panel. Kennedy had tried to answer questions the Kopechnes had about their daughter's death, he said. For the rest, it will all come out. The questions, all the answers. And I think people will understand. But it will just have to wait. For the senator's office to generate favorable stories, seeking to exculpate him of any blame in the accident and dismiss the dangers of the forthcoming inquest, didn't sit very well with Edward Hanafy, reflecting a continuing struggle between the senator's lawyers and his political advisors. Hanafy had opposed the senator making the TV speech, Dick McCarron said. Everyone agreed it had been a mistake. Efforts to rescue the senator's political reputation were jeopardizing the defense of his case. The peril of possible criminal charges issuing from the inquest was serious enough not to risk further damage to his legal position by indulging in a public dialogue about the accident. McCarron received a call from Hanafy during a dull interval in the case. Nothing much was going on, McCarron said. Hanafy felt there was just too much interference with Ted's political people in the management of the case, that we couldn't function properly as attorneys under those circumstances. Their insistence on issuing public relations statements was making a legal defense of Senator Kennedy virtually impossible. Hanafy intended to resign from the case unless he was given free rein, without interference from Kennedy's staff or advisors. He was soliciting the support of other lawyers employed in the senator's defense to present a united front. McCarron agreed to join Hanafy, Judge Clark, and his son to walk off the case. Hanafy's ultimatum had its effect. McCarron said, "He stayed on. We all did." Kennedy could not bear the spectacle of his legal team abandoning his defense prior to the argument of his appeal before the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court. Senator Kennedy would make no political appearances while court action was pending, his office announced. The self-imposed moratorium would prevent the senator from participating in a special election in the 6th Congressional District in Massachusetts. Kennedy had given his implied endorsement to Democratic candidate Michael Harrington before the accident, but since that time had no connection with the campaign. Because the election was regarded as a possible trendsetter for 1970, Edmund Muskie and George McGovern had appeared for the candidate. Hubert Humphrey and other prominent Democrats were scheduled to campaign. Kennedy wasn't going to take part, a Harrington aide said. The decision was made not to invite him because it wouldn't help. But denying Senator Kennedy a public platform from which to discuss the accident didn't stanch the tireless efforts of his staff to defend the legal blockade imposed upon the inquest. Friend and political ally, Senator Birch Bayh, among others, took up the cudgel. Ted Kennedy was anxious to tell all he knew about the accident, Bayh said. The matter has to be cleared up completely. I think Ted wants to make available all the information. Bai had been involved in an accident himself, which had left him so confused, he had assumed for 24 hours that he was responsible for someone's death. Not until he called the home of the deceased to extend his sympathy had he learned that another driver was to blame. Bai cited the incident as a possible explanation for Senator Kennedy's failure to report the accident for more than 9 hours. It was too early to tell how badly Chappaquiddick had hurt Kennedy's political career, Bai said. Some polls say he's completely through. My judgment is that this is not completely true. He has a tremendous hold on young people. It amounts to almost worship. And young people are prone to forgive and forget. Bai's analysis was not borne out by a survey published by the Boston Globe on September 22nd, revealing that the greatest drop in approval for Senator Kennedy in Massachusetts had occurred in 18 to 20-year-olds. The slide was so precipitous that it fueled rumors of an impending resignation. Governor Francis Sargent went so far as to request a review of the procedure for naming Kennedy's replacement. Should the court strike down his appeal and require Kennedy to testify at a public inquest, he might resign before facing revelations of wrongdoing. That speculation appeared uppermost in Edward Hanafy's mind when he rose to argue the appeal before the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court. Hanafy wanted the court to determine whether the inquest statutes had become outmoded by recent U.S. Supreme Court decisions. Unless new ground rules were laid down, the procedure could be unconstitutional, Hanafy said. The evil to be averted was the use of a judicial proceeding prior to a formal indictment, generating massive and gratuitous publicity which could prejudice Senator Kennedy's case and deprive him of a fair trial in any subsequent criminal action. As evidence, Hanafy brought a compendium of press clippings to the courtroom and cited the Dr. Sam Shepard murder case as an example of publicity developing from a flood into a tidal wave. Note. On July 4, 1954, 31-year-old Marilyn Shepard, wife of Dr. Sam Shepard, a wealthy osteopathic neurosurgeon, was beaten to death in her suburban Cleveland home. Shepard was tried and convicted of second-degree murder in one of the most highly publicized and sensational trials of modern times. In November 1961, a young lawyer, F. Lee Bailey, appealed the case, charging that the press had deliberately and with malice published articles implicating Shepard. At the culmination of a series of appeals on June 6, 1966, the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Shepard's conviction, citing the trial judge's failure to protect Shepard sufficiently from the massive, pervasive, and prejudicial publicity that attended his prosecution. At a second trial 6 months later, Dr. Shepard was found not guilty. Hanafy asked the court to bar the press and public from the inquest, disqualify Judge Boyle from presiding, and, should the inquest reflect any wrongdoing on Senator Kennedy's part, to suppress the report and transcript of testimony until the conclusion of any prosecution or trial. Assistant Attorney General Joseph Hurley hit the publicity issue head-on. The prejudice complaint in Shepard, he argued, had occurred after the accused was arrested and during the course of his trial. In reversing the conviction, the Supreme Court had not held reporters should be excluded from the courtroom, but that the trial judge should have controlled them better. The principle that justice could not survive behind walls of silence had long been reflected in the Anglo-American distrust of secret trials. A responsible press was the handmaiden of effective judicial administration, especially in criminal cases, not only publishing information about trials, but guarding against miscarriages of justice by subjecting police, prosecutors, and the judicial process to public scrutiny. The courts had, traditionally, refused to place any limitation on freedom of the press, even while sometimes deploring its sensationalism. The news media was not concerned with Senator Kennedy's guilt or innocence with regard to the death of Mary Jo Kopechne, but his career as a U.S. senator and his future in national politics, Hurley said. The inquest should be public for the same reason Kennedy had gone on television, to end innuendo and gossip. The peak of publicity had been reached following the senator's broadcast. The rights of privacy of the other petitioners had been lost, Hurley went on, by their action of attending a social event with Senator Kennedy, a person of great prominence. Their constitutional rights would be infringed only if publicity adversely influenced the outcome of a judicial proceeding to which they became parties. Publicity about an open inquest did not make the publicity prejudicial. A secret inquest would also generate publicity. Because of the extreme interest in the case, you might close the doors, but you couldn't keep secret what was going on inside, Hurley said. Reporters would work diligently to discover what was going on, and, as a result, inaccurate information about the proceedings would be published. An inquest could clear a person of suspicion as well as indicate guilt, and preserve the good name of Mary Jo Kopechne, even though she is not a party to the hearing, Hurley said. Nor was an inquest a first step on a stairway leading to criminal prosecution, but complete in and of itself. Its purpose served when the presiding judge filed a report to the Superior Court. There may be criminal proceedings, Hurley said, but I know of none. If Hurley and Hanafy were unwilling to declare exactly what was feared in the holding of an inquest, Henry Monahan did not hesitate to do so in a brief filed on behalf of the Civil Liberties Union of Massachusetts, as amicus curiae. Unless criminal prosecution were commenced against Senator Kennedy or some other person, it is doubtful there is any constitutionally acceptable basis for holding an inquest. Under Boyle's ground rules, Kennedy could stand publicly accused of Mary Jo Kopechne's death. Having pleaded guilty to one offense arising out of the accident, Kennedy could be reported to be the person whose unlawful act or negligence appeared to have contributed thereto, Monahan said. Accordingly, he faces the possibility of a manslaughter proceeding. If the district attorney desired a public trial, then Senator Kennedy must be afforded the procedural safeguards which attended the criminal process, Monahan argued. If the Commonwealth wasn't willing to grant those rights, it could proceed by way of a grand jury, whose proceedings were always secret. While an indictment may be returned, Senator Kennedy would be spared the intense glare of one-sided publicity, which could jeopardize his right to a fair trial. Chapter 46. Denise did, in fact, get his chance to give the case to the grand jury when it reconvened in Edgartown on October 14th. As he had done so often before in this case, he went to the brink and then shied away from taking the plunge. Juror Teresa Morse recalled that Denise was all fire and brimstone when he addressed the jury. He said he wanted our help because he was going to get Kennedy if it was the last act of his life. He wasn't going to buy his way out of this one. It didn't matter how much money he had or how much power he had. The facts were going to be known. The jury could help the most by not getting in the way at all, Denise said. The body of Mary Jo Kopechne was going to be exhumed, an autopsy performed, and an inquest held. Denise was going to get to the truth of the matter, and then, if he needed us, he was going to call us back, Morse said. The grand jury was all in a loving spirit of cooperation, and we cooperated with Mr. Denise. That the grand jury was recessed instead of discharged provoked speculation Denise was leaving the door open to present the case to them should the Supreme Judicial Court rule his inquest request was invalid. A recess allowed time for the court to decide Kennedy's appeal. But Denise was either playing fast and loose with the grand jury, or rehearsing in public a private ambivalence about prosecuting Ted Kennedy. He would not seek a grand jury investigation regardless of the court's decision, he said a week later in Wilkes Barre. Such an action would place me in control of the investigation, and I prefer a judge to retain that responsibility. Denise was about to have his day in court. A second Kopechne motion to dismiss the request for an autopsy had charged the amended petition had included no new evidence to indicate an autopsy would add anything to what was already known about Mary Jo Kopechne's death. Nor was an autopsy needed to solve a crime Denise had no reason to suspect had been committed. Our position is quite simple. No crime, no criminal conduct, no autopsy, Kopechne lawyer Joseph Flanagan said. We are going to do everything we can to stop the district attorney from going on a fishing expedition. He can't seek his evidence in the grave without providing facts that the evidence is there. Judge Brominski dismissed the motion. In his ruling, he said the interests of the public and the Kopechnes could best be served by developing the facts at a hearing that would allow the court to resolve the question of exhumation and autopsy without further delay. It was a decision so obvious, some legal observers wondered why it had taken Brominski 3 months to make it. Before the hearing, Flanagan visited Edgartown to interview potential witnesses, examine the scene of the accident, and ask Arena only routine questions about my investigation. Flanagan denied Senator Kennedy was involved in the fight against exhumation. Ted Kennedy would very much like to have an autopsy performed, Kennedy spokesman William Vandenhuvel said. The senator was in close touch with the Kopechnes, aides in his office revealed. His battle against a belated autopsy was less than for legal reasons. His advisors think it could only help him, then in sympathy with their opposition. Flanagan refused to say whether the Kopechnes are paying for this trip or is someone else. The Kopechnes had turned down a few offers of help with the legal expenses of barring the autopsy. This is our responsibility, Joseph Kopechne said. We haven't stopped to think about the cost of it all. We'll worry about that when it's all over. The lawyers have been very good, letting us pay what we could afford. Even if we're overruled, it won't be the end of it. We'll go as high as we have to. George Killen was also in Edgartown lining up witnesses for the hearing. His most delicate mission was to persuade Dr. Donald Mills to testify on behalf of the petition. Killen wasn't blaming anybody but himself for releasing the body of Mary Jo Kopechne without autopsy. He had no intention of corroborating Denise's claim to have ordered an autopsy on the morning her body left Edgartown. Kopechne lawyers had already expressed an interest in having him testify, Mills said. It was debatable which side Mills would benefit the most. There was no question whose side John Farrar was on when Killen took his detailed statement. As captain of the Search and Rescue Division of Edgartown's Volunteer Fire Department, Farrar had made his own study of the accident. In Farrar's version, the car had been traveling 30 miles per hour, and had hit the water at a 45-degree angle. Kennedy had been able to escape, because with the roll of the car, the driver's side window would have been the last one submerged, Farrar said. Mary Jo Kopechne had assumed a conscious position in the back seat. She was rebreathing her own air. The oxygen content was lowering from 21% as she used it up and replaced it with carbon dioxide, Farrar said. As the CO2 builds up, you breathe heavier and heavier. The emotional trauma is extensive. Try putting a plastic bag over your head and breathing. You can feel the anxiety coming over you. Then try to imagine that bag being held over your head by a 300-pound wrestler, and think of having to struggle to get out of that situation, knowing you might be breathing your last. It's a very, very scary situation. The anxiety that sets in is just unbelievable. The length of time a pocket of air remained in a submerged automobile was a matter no human being can swear to. But she could have lived for a good while after the car went off the bridge, Farrar estimated. She was alive easily an hour. Farrar produced a sketch of the body's position in the accident car, redrawn 3 times by an artist, to become as close as possible to that which I observed, to aid in the presentation of his testimony at the exhumation hearing. Impressed by the passionate advocacy with which Farrar expressed his theories, Killen thought, he's going to make one hell of a witness. So did Assistant District Attorney Armand Fernandez, who accompanied Killen to take Farrar's statement, which, if allowed to become part of the record, could be very damaging to Ted Kennedy. Thanks to a special $15,000 appropriation voted by the Massachusetts legislature to fund the investigation, Denise was able to assemble a panel of 14 witnesses and experts to appear with him in Wilkes Barre. It was 10 a.m. on October 20th, 1969, when Judge Brominski opened the hearing in Luzerne County Courthouse. While welcoming reporters to the packed courtroom, Rominski also admonished them to observe certain rules for this case. You will be required to remain in your assigned places until such time as court recesses or adjourns a session, he said. If reporters left the courtroom, they would not be readmitted until the following day. Any violation of his guidelines would result in the revocation of your press pass. But no reporter was likely to chance missing out on the first courtroom confrontation in the case, a virtual preview of the postponed inquest. Armand Fernandez, who had prepared the hearings case, opened argument by reciting the Massachusetts law, granting district attorneys authority to request autopsies on their own authority. As his first witness, Fernandez called Police Chief Dominic Arena to the stand to relate the events of Saturday, July 19th, after he had been summoned to Dyke Bridge on Chappaquiddick and returned to Edgartown Police Station to receive a statement about the accident from Senator Kennedy. Representing the Kopechnys, Joseph Flanagan objected to the senator's statement being placed into evidence as hearsay. Fernandez was not concerned with establishing what the senator said at this time was true. That may be hearsay. The report was being offered as a statement made of the facts and circumstances, he said. We're not concerned with the truth of it. Rominski refused to allow it. To rule an official police document inadmissible in a judicial proceeding stirred reporters in the courtroom to murmurs of disbelief, no matter which legal hairs were being split. Denise himself examined the next witness, scuba diver John Farrar. Battered by news media accusations that he was prejudiced, biased, and anti-Kennedy, Farrar had retained attorney Herb Abrams for advice and assistance in the preparation of his testimony. Farrar had anticipated being asked for a professional opinion as to whether Mary Jo Kopechne could have been alive upon her removal from the submerged car if sufficient air had been trapped. It was a chance he would not get. Rominski dismissed as immaterial and irrelevant the statement Abrams made to introduce Farrar's testimony. Denise did not ask Farrar about airlocks or Mary Jo Kopechne's longevity underwater, restricting him to a description of the automobile's position in Poca Pond, the damage sustained to it in the accident, and the process whereby Farrar had recovered the body. If Farrar's potentially damaging testimony could be elided, Huck Look's couldn't be. His very appearance on the witness stand, robust and ruddy, a plain-spoken rustic, was a rebuff to those who had questioned his credibility. Look's description of a car whose driver appeared confused, and his recognition of the same automobile the next morning when it was dragged from Poca Pond, was devastating in its direct and simply stated sincerity. Under oath, Look placed the time of his encounter at approximately 12:40 a.m. to 12:45 a.m. Saturday morning, a direct challenge to Senator Kennedy's version of the accident. There wasn't much Flanagan could do but try to cast doubt on Look's ability to read a license plate in the dark. But Look easily disposed of that cavil. There were lights on in the car, backup lights, taillights, and number plate lights. Did it appear to you that the driver of the car was in a confused state? Flanagan asked. Yes, sir, Look said. Yet despite the fact that this driver appeared to be in a confused state, you did not follow the car or make any attempt to stop it that night, did you? No, sir, Look said. Did the car move away from you slowly? Flanagan continued. No, sir, Look answered. I would say hurriedly. Before he could call out an offer of help, the car had driven off at approximately 25 to 30 miles per hour, Look said. There was a lot of dust. All I could see was just the lights going down the road. Look's appearance on the witness stand brought Herbert Jack Miller to the courtroom to confirm Bernie Flynn's intelligence about him as the most dangerous witness expected to testify at the inquest with regard to the time of the accident and the reason for Kennedy's wrong turn to avoid confrontation with a police officer. Informed by two reporters during a recess that Miller was attending his examination of Look, Fernandez recognized his name as a Washington attorney of some ability. Like you would know F. Lee Bailey by his reputation, he said. But there was no association with anybody as far as I was concerned. If Look represented the most danger to Kennedy's case at the inquest, Dr. Donald Mills was the biggest obstacle Denise had to get over in order to secure an exhumation and autopsy. Denise left his examination to Fernandez. Mills was sticking to his diagnosis. His examination of Mary Jo Kopechne had revealed she had the characteristic foam that goes with a drowning case. She had no evidence of injuries. Flanagan drove the point home forcefully under cross-examination. In your examination of the body, Doctor, did you find any signs of foul play?
I did not, Mills said.
Did you have any reason to believe there was any criminal conduct that may have resulted in the girl's death?
I have no reason to believe any such thing, Mills snapped.
But Denise had a corps of experts waiting in the wings to dismember Mills' testimony and to call into question the soundness of his drowning conclusion. Among them was Dr. Cyril Wecht, coroner of Allegheny County, Pennsylvania. External examination alone frequently failed to reveal if body organs had been lacerated, several kinds of poisonings, a fractured skull or a broken neck, Dr. Wecht testified. It was possible for a competent forensic pathologist to perform an autopsy on an embalmed body buried 4 months and still arrive at quite substantial and valid opinions with more than a reasonable degree of medical certainty that could verify, modify, or even completely negate Dr. Mills's findings. That Mary Jo Kopechne had been found inside an automobile suggested the possibility that a significant injury may have occurred prior to her death, Dr. Joseph Spellman, medical examiner for the city of Philadelphia, testified. He found little significance in the pink froth about the nose and mouth of the victim, a phenomenon which appeared in other forms of death such as heart failure and drug overdose. Would this include manual strangulation? Fernandez asked. Flanagan objected to the question. So did Brominski. He wanted Fernandez to stay away from that line of questioning. The question came up because we were trying to find out what other kinds of injuries could result in the things the medical examiner found in Mary Jo Kopechne's case, Fernandez said later. Dr. George Katsas, who performed most autopsies on Cape Cod, had alerted the district attorney that strangulation was one of several things that could have brought about the same conditions. That, Fernandez would say later, was why the question was used. A highly respected forensic pathologist, formerly attached to the Department of Legal Medicine at Harvard Medical School, Katsas would have performed an autopsy on Mary Jo Kopechne had Denise ordered one. On the witness stand, Katsas testified that an experienced forensic pathologist could recognize and evaluate aspects of disease and injury in an embalmed and exhumed body. In Katsas' opinion, external examination alone did not exclude the presence of internal injuries, fractures or ruptures of organs which may have contributed to the death, or even have caused the death. Preparing Katsas to appear at the hearing, Killen had some questions of his own not put to him on the witness stand. Prudish and puritanical, disliking smutty talk, Killen had nevertheless considered Bernie Flynn's opinion that a sexual interlude could have accounted for the hour and a half between the time Ted Kennedy said he'd left the cottage and the time Huck Look saw the car at the intersection. Lab tests for semen had been negative, but Mary Jo Kopechne had not been wearing underpants, Flynn pointed out. So obviously you couldn't make a test on underpants. Any seepage would be on the slacks. Katsas had performed the difficult post-mortems in the Costa murders. Microscopic examination of vaginal smears taken from two badly mutilated bodies, buried for 6 weeks in a Truro woods, had revealed the presence of male spermatozoa. Killen wanted to know if it was possible to detect evidence of sexual intercourse in an embalmed body buried for over 3 months. Finding sperm was remote in exhumed bodies, Katsas told Killen, but no one could be absolutely certain without an autopsy, and serological tests of a vaginal swab for semen markers, a number of common chemicals found in male ejaculate, a biological fluid rich in certain proteins. Semen contained 400 times more of the enzyme acid phosphatase than any other body fluid. An AP-positive swab would indicate maybe on sexual intercourse. If sperm were not detected,
The serologist looked for sperming, a chemical contained in seminal states, and P30, a protein found only in semen. Sperm and P30 were the only conclusive tests. But, Katz has added, chances of